She loved the sea. She liked the sharp, salty smell of the air and the vastness of horizons bound only by a vault of azure sky above. It made her feel small, but free as well.
Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we thought it best to rename and rebrand ourselves freshly just in time for the game to do the same with its second edition. Tune in each episode for your dose of strategy, discussion, jokes, and good old geek culture. A huge thank you goes out to George R.R. Martin, Fantasy Flight Games, Card Game DB, and you, our loyal and new listeners. Check us out at www.whitebookpodcast.com and contact us on Facebook and Twitter or email us at contact@whitebookpodcast.com. This CC licensed music is Townfish by Spinozar.
Yeah, well, you know what? We're running out of good ones.
And there's no more coming for quite a while.
Exactly.
That one was from Will's self-titled romance novel. Not really.
Will Lentz, a romance novel?
Exactly.
That's the self-titled
It's an auto-erotic biography.
It did sound like the audiobook version of your erotic biography, is what it sounded.
So, there's an erotic biography where you just talk about your conquests in bed, like you leave out your life, it's just one laid of sex.
Well, I mean, for Will, that's just like, and then I met Chris, and that's the whole book.
Aww.
I can't tell if that was like a endearing aw, like Kristen's whole word, like like kind of sad that's just Kristen. I mean, I guess it depends on your perspective, and how you interpreted that tells a lot about you as a person.
It does. It does indeed. You know, I always love when the podcast really gives the audience and the hosts a chance for real deep self-reflection.
Is there going to be a bonus version with an epilogue featuring the Gen Con mishaps? That was another quote from his autobiography, and you guys totally missed it. We should introduce this British guy.
What British guy?
We have a British guy?
James, it's your turn to talk. Sorry, I thought we were going to do dead air. I thought that was good for podcasts.
I was just busy thinking about how I barely notice British accents anymore. I watch so much BBC. I think I mentioned forever ago on the show before when I was complaining to some friends, like, man, you know, Arthur is a pretty good series, but it's driving me crazy. Like, I've watched like a whole season and no one's speaking in an accent. Like, shouldn't they be? And then they're like, what are you smoking? Like, they all have accents.
It's weird because I've had the opposite happen where, like, I'll listen to, you know, the White Book and not hear anything different or weird about it at all. And then, like, you had the episode where Dave came on and it was like, what's this crazy accent? And it's like, oh, right, it's the accent that I live with.
I guess it just stands out more when the other voices with it are different.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, there we go.
But yeah, hi, I'm James, JC Wammer on the boards.
Hi, James.
Hi, Carl.
I'm Aaron.
Aaron.
Hi, Carl.
Hi, Aaron.
I'm Will.
Hi, Will.
Hi, James. Hi, Kyle. Hi, Aaron.
This is
hi, listeners.
Aaron didn't say hi.
I did say hi to Will. I was like, I don't actually like Will today.
Yeah, oh.
It's fine.
So it's a boring
I don't know why.
I killed it.
Yeah, you know, we started off so strong, and now everything's just kind of wandered. We lost our energy. It was that introspection. I'm telling you, folks, never think too hard about your outlook on life. Hey, you know, speaking of delaying the inevitable, you know what? It still feels like there haven't been hardly enough cards released for second edition yet. But we did have a little bit of news today on the card front. No, we didn't have the release of a new pack, but we did have the release of a new preview article for the, I believe, fifth chapter pack in this cycle, titled Calm Over Westeros.
Hey, I think I played that block.
Yeah, sounds very familiar there. Noticing kind of a theme with these titles.
Yeah, we have
cards we already have.
I mean, what were the others? The Road to Winterfell we don't have, I guess. What were the other ones?
Mm. Taking the Black.
Yeah, we've got Take the Black.
Oh, Take the Black? Because I've been calling it Taking the Black. I guess I've been saying that wrong.
Oh, no, the chapter pack is Taking. The card is Take.
Okay.
Fascinating pedantry on the whiteboard.
Well, you know, James, I don't know if you recall the episode where Brett Zeiler and I argued for probably a solid 20 minutes on Wilding versus Wildling and how that should be ruled in a tournament.
I
think we are no strangers to such arguments.
That was one of the very first episodes of 2C1C I ever listened to.
And you kept listening?
I know.
It was an
I am just quite amazed.
It was an episode with just Will and Zyler, so I didn't listen.
I think the episode after that was the one where you talked about all of Daryl's misplays. And so it's like, oh yeah, okay, this is still good.
Okay, yeah. Well, I mean, pretty much any opportunity to have Daryl on the show is always a shining light in the darkness. But again, we digress.
So yeah. What was announced in Calm Over Westeros?
You know, surprisingly little, which I find kind of interesting. It feels like there's much less being introduced to us in this preview article. Of course, we have our little five-card spread with some interesting stuff. There's a Tyrell army that we can see all of that seems, you know, maybe not that great. And then a couple Targaryen cards that are much more interesting. I am kind of curious if you guys think, you know, what kind of precedent we're getting with these seven-cost characters. I don't know if they're all quite there, but do you think Miri Mazdur carries that banner well enough at that cost?
I don't have a way to play a seven-cost non-mortal lady.
Yeah, I think right now, economically, she's too hard to afford. I think long-term, these seven-costers either need to keep having the lord or lady trait so that you can actually afford them with noble cause, or we need to wait until the game expands its economy a bit more. I mean, like we saw, for example, a 10 gold plot I remember we saw is going to come out. We don't know the details of it yet, but unless the text makes it absolutely suck, that sort of card might make her playable. Until then, I can't see myself actually ever being in a position where I've got 7 gold that I can burn without worry.
She's a good ability. Like, remember how good Piapri was. She's going to be opportunistic. She's not going to be useful every turn, but she's going to force, at the very least, absolutely force defenders, which is never necessarily a bad thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there are combos that exist in the card pool, like combining her with Jousting Contest, being able to stand her with Illyrio, boosting her strength with like Widow's Wail and the like.
Or even just blowing out a defender with Dracarys.
Yes. Yeah,
all around. She's definitely interesting. I don't know. I would have liked a way. I mean, I guess, again, we'll see if we have ways to play her. If we have ways to play her, she's probably not going to be a centerpiece, but she's a card worth playing.
Yeah. It's one of those things where the upside is amazing, but it needs to be.
Yeah, exactly.
I like her a lot. I mean, I think targeted control can never be understated. I like it.
Yeah. I mean, unless the things are weak enough to burn with Dracarys, Targaryen doesn't really have that much targeted control as of yet, because, I mean, they don't have, like, their big character isn't a military icon, unless, obviously, you give Dany serious training or whatever. So having ways that you can target control anyone is quite important, I think.
There's also Drogo. I mean, he's a thing that exists.
Well, yeah. I don't think you'd be playing her and Dany and Drogo in the same deck, though, somehow.
But you could not be playing Dany, and she goes reasonably well with Drogo. Like, if you get a couple military claim off, or even if you just intrigue with her, you're probably going to get both military off because they're going to have to overcommit up.
Yeah, and I think the all aggro, all the time deck, being able to do two military challenges and get sort of effectively an even better military claim off one of the other challenges, it's going to be very tough for people to keep characters on the board if that deck gets rolling.
Yeah, plus Plaza of Punishment. There's definitely something there.
And Tears, I mean, just a 2-for-1 off of Intrigue alone, even if you don't have Drogo, I mean, she can just make one challenge to find and flip the game. If you can just get her to go off once, you can, just shock and awe.
She's certainly good with Nymeria Sand.
Everything is good with Nymeria Sand. That's like saying it can be cancelled by treachery. It just goes without saying.
I can't wait for Nymeria Sand.
You know, Miri Mazdura can be cancelled by treachery.
She can. Okay, that's decided. It's terrible. Can be cancelled by treachery. Seven cost for a blank character. Don't like it.
Moving on to Blood Magic Ritual, which oddly enough also blinks characters.
That card is bad.
Yeah,
you know, I don't know how terrible it is, especially... I can think of situations. I mean, obviously they mentioned the Jorah Mormont play to blink his text box. But I can think of situations where I might want a couple of these in the deck as an oops button, where I might even use it on a Daenerys who I then plan on maybe, I don't know, marching away next turn so that I can play a dupe rather than her being dead and. So that I couldn't, or I'm going to plan on bouncing her to hand afterward with Waking the Dragon, right?
But why wouldn't you just run Bodyguard instead of Blood Magic Ritual?
You know, that one is a good question.
I mean, I guess the answer's meant to be in fealty. This is a loyal target card rather than a neutral card. But yeah, my opinion on this is that it sort of does a little of various cards. There's a bit of Milk of the Poppy in there. There's a bit of Bodyguard or Fire and Blood or whatever, but I don't think it's actually as good as any of those cards. But I mean, there's been a lot of debate on this on Card Game DB, and it seems a pretty sort of 50-50 split, I'd say, between either thinking it's great and versatile and useful in lots of scenarios or thinking it's just not good enough at any point. So, Aaron, decide for us.
Oh no, it's a definitely bad card, and whenever we agree on a card, we're usually right, because we never freaking agree on a card.
I go back and forth. I think I'm currently leaning in the bad card camp, but if you had a deck that was a bunch of really vanilla things without text boxes, or if Tar gets more of these negative text boxes, like akin to Jorah, I could see running it, but right now, probably not.
I do like the idea of a potential future deck where you just have a deck full of incredibly efficient cards with negative text boxes, and then you just spend the entire game blanking your own characters.
I mean, if Night's Watch gets enough efficient characters, Night's Watch will be mostly no attachments.
Yeah, and that is true. One advantage of this is that you can save a no attachments character with it and then dodge the downside. Because it's save, then attach. So on the dragons, for instance.
Oh, wait, one point. I keep seeing people be like, oh my god, I can use this on the Hound. A, if your Hound is getting killed that much, you're doing it wrong. B, you want the Hound to be bouncing people. Like, that's not a downside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, ultimately, I guess the comparison point is Risen from the Sea, which is cheaper than this and has an upside instead of a downside.
Yeah.
It can only go on Greyjoy characters, obviously saves as a Greyjoy theme, whereas it isn't for Targ. But still, it's... If I'm playing Blood Magic Ritual and I'm playing against a Greyjoy opponent and they use Risen from the Sea, I just feel like a chump, I think.
I mean, it is a very Nedley card. I mean, this is the Blood Magic Ritual. Yeah, you saved him, but he's not quite what he was the first go-around.
If only Daenerys had fetched Maester Cressen instead of that pillow, then the entire way the books went might have been different.
Aww. How does that play out? Cressen walks into the tent and does his weird shit, and suddenly Drogo's back to his normal self.
You should see Cressen's work with his hands. It's amazing.
Aww.
He can already make you resist the effects of opium. He can already treat you so well that he removes your bodyguard.
Yeah, you feel so great, you think you don't need one anymore. You're king of the world.
It's just the power of positivity.
Man, I almost wish that I was still doing amusing episode titles. Power of positivity would be a pretty good one.
Speaking of the power of positivity, I want to prop James right at the start of this episode.
Okay.
I think why is fairly important, especially for new players. Like, if you've ever, read a comment board that both James and I are on, or comments under the post, you know James and I argue, like cats and dogs is the cliche, but like we argue so much worse than that. And he's still someone I consider a friend. We talk literally all the time. Like we disagree on cards, but we agree on a game and getting beers and having a good time. And I think like that's probably a good way to sum up the community as a whole.
Yeah, I think that's always the universal truth, is when you're truly friends with someone, you can basically be rude to their face and get away with it and still be friends afterwards.
Cheers.
And one important note, I think, for listeners who are busy rolling their eyes and they're like, Aaron, you're an English teacher, and here you are using literally to mean figuratively. And I actually want to step in and point out, no, I think he actually did mean it correctly there. It was terrible to try to get the two of them to stop talking in a different Skype window so that we could actually record this show.
Yeah, when we're not arguing on a podcast, we're arguing off a podcast.
Entirely true.
But yeah, I think it's I do like also that we have completely different opinions about everything, except for the part where you're doing really, really well with second edition, and I'm just kind of doing mediocre, which is kind of proving you right, and it's really frustrating.
It's pretty great, because I was wrong all the time about first, so it's
nice. I do want to get points for calling that we didn't need Valor, because I remember you being a big advocate for having Valor as early as possible in the game. And then a couple of episodes back, you said, I can sort of start to see a game without Valor here. And I was like, yes!
Yeah, I mean, I still have that one. I want it, but I don't need it. I don't like those giant 30-strength boards. And I still think Wildfire is actively bad. Like, I still think Wildfire is actively bad.
Yeah, I mean, I heard you. I just wasn't going to dignify it with a response.
Speaking of people I don't agree with on guards.
That makes for good radio, though, am I right?
Yeah. But no, I don't know. I think it's hit or miss whether we actually disagree on stuff these days. I think we did much more before we started talking and reviewing stuff together. There's some bleed over in viewpoints that I think happens when you regularly do that kind of thing.
You've reviewed every card that exists for the past 2.5 years or so. Yes.
Yeah.
You start to see each other's points.
Maybe that means that we have to bring a guest on every episode that we review stuff. Shake things up a little.
That's a really good idea. We should do that.
Yeah, we should get on that.
Just get Kyle to be as antagonistic as possible at all times.
I can do that.
Yeah, you're the perfect man for the job.
I don't think you can. I think you've lost your fastball, Kyle.
Aww.
Since you started those weird hours, you've been so much nicer.
Oh, gee, yeah. I don't have. Yeah, having the energy to be an asshole is just not. It's not there, guys. Like when you're up all night, you're just like, can we just all get along and take a nap?
I just took a nap and woke up to do this.
Oh, I want to take a nap so bad.
You know, I think now that we have brought the conversation around to taking naps, it's probably time to continue on and keep the ball moving. I know we have a couple other announcements we wanted to hit on early in the episode here before we get into a couple of our topics. I think Aaron has a bit of a new project here related to the show that he wanted to introduce to listeners.
Sure. Well, let's start with, if you haven't been keeping an eye on whitebookpodcast.com, we've had something like 3 or 4 articles already this week, and they're awesome, so you need to get over there and read that. I mean, I only wrote 2 of them this time. The big one, I think, for the week is John Darknodge from Beyond the Wall and myself have started a YouTube page where we build decks, play decks. We're going to do other stuff. We're basically going to try and do all the extra thrown stuff that the podcast doesn't do, so you can have a visual medium along with this. Watch us play some games. So please subscribe to Beyond the White Book on YouTube.
Yeah, I got to actually throw out some pre-prop accolades to our writing staff, who's kind of been kicking things up a notch, and to that title, Beyond the White Book, which really tickles my fancy.
Yeah, I was pretty entertained by that. We are still working out technical glitches. One of our listeners is awesomely making us an intro video. Things are coming together. So keep up, stay tuned. And I'm pretty good at 2.0 and John's pretty good at like winning national titles and shit like that. You should really pay attention. It's good.
I thought you were being modest there when you said I'm pretty 2.0.
Like, oh, yeah, the hubris just oozes out of his voice.
Win all my games, it's fine. I'm not bad. But then you downgrade John to being, oh, he's pretty. He wins some world championships or something. I know, whatever. It's like, okay, no, Aaron's just downplaying everything. That's fine.
Look, I don't pretend I'm better than John. Like, that's just, like, John on Octagon is good, and then you play John in a tournament. You're like, what the hell, man? Like, he's
that's always
really
so annoying. Tagore does that too. Obviously not to the same level as John, but his favorite trick is to be awful on Octagon and then beat me in real life. It's like, come on, man.
Tagore is annoying, man. Tagore.
Well, then, a little bit of other kind of bookkeeping issues here. I'm going to throw out a couple mentions on the site. The event listing system, I think, continues to pick up steam. This week we've added another, I think, 7 events, if I remember right. counting recurring events, the site tells me we have 2,074 events listed. That, of course, is counting every instance of recurring events out through the rest of the year. But, hey, that's still going to mean we have a few hundred events listed here, which is pretty sweet, actually. So come check things out. If you know of any of events that are going on, head over to the whitebookpodcast.com and list those there. It's store championship season, and we don't have nearly enough of those scheduled on here yet.
While we're at it, I'm still posting winning deck lists, so keep sending those in as well. Quite a few. I updated, got 14 or so on Sunday.
Well, the last one here, this one is going to be both very vague and rather specific all at once. And despite the fact that James told me that's a poor idea for something else a little while ago, I did want to go ahead and mention, in case there are interested parties that have not noticed the help cover costs donation button there on the White Book website. We do have a few costs around here, and I've got a couple projects kicking around behind the scenes that if they go well, I think it could be a big boon to the community. I don't quite want to unveil them yet. And get things out there prematurely, but I would love to use them to enrich the community here. So if anyone happens to feel interested in chipping in for that, please do utilize that donation function. And of course, once I have this up and running and feel like I can kind of debut the project more fully, I'm going to be posting info out there for folks to kind of track expenses and where these things are being spent. So we're gonna be transparent about it. But if anybody wants to go ahead and jump in now to help get the ball rolling, feel free.
Good job mentioning that, because I hadn't noticed that on the site. And looking at it, it's just sort of on the right hand side, quite near the bottom of the page, and it's like I don't scroll down that far.
FFG caused controversy again.
You know, that is probably a good thing in some ways. You know, it's been a solid, couple months since they've done that before?
I mean, I guess, but Alex and our James right here accused them of all smoking drugs.
Alex is the one who made the drug smoking accusation. I just didn't stop it.
They're so unprofessional over at Beyond the Wall. Jesus.
So, well, since we do have you on the show, then we don't necessarily need to just read the documents out to the listeners. You can go double check the FFG website here for more information on the changes and tweaks to the FFG's organized play program. The kind of introductory article about that, titled "A Step Forward," posted on the 21st of December, it looks like. And of course, on Card Game DB, you can read those articles. But James, in a nutshell, you know, kind of enlighten us on what these changes mean.
So basically, on, I think it was New Year's Eve, FFG put up this article, as you say, and it states how many rounds you're meant to use in a tournament for what number of players, and then the size of the cup that you should use. And there was a lot of controversy, mainly because the size of the cup is very small. It suggests that you shouldn't have a cup if you have 16 or fewer players, and it suggests that if you have 40 players, you should only have a cup to top four, which is quite mental. There's been a lot of discussion about it. I know Alex and Drakey and I were very annoyed. We wrote an article about it. It's on Card Game DB.
It's a good article, and you know, there's a lot to it, so some of these things we kind of chit-chat about may overlap there, and I don't want to just reread that, but what you just pointed out about the Swiss rounds kind of boggles my mind, because I'm here staring at this line here about how these larger tournaments are going to be having an increased size of cut. But you guys, you know, pretty well illustrated that's not the case.
Yeah, it seems like when I first saw the numbers, I genuinely thought they were an error. I assumed that it was a typo from another game or something, and they'd just forgotten to change the numbers around. But no, it seems like that's what they're sticking with. Today, on the day we're recording, so Wednesday, there was a clarification post in the forums in which Pipes Evan said that the rules were only intended for store championships, not for anything more important than that, and that they'll post another article soon, sort of expanding on the reasons why a bit more.
It's interesting. I don't know. Maybe I'm just too cynical here, but that really seems like a CYA scramble when I'm reading this initial article that very much presents it all as a top to bottom solution.
Yeah, and also I like the ambition that FFG is showing then in assuming that a store championship might have 149 and above players.
That's pretty impressive. Pretty impressive. And, you know, especially if we make that assumption that the game is going to grow to such levels, it's all the more interesting to see the awkward dual pressure that this combination of tweaks cause on people to, I think, increase the odds of leaving a poor taste in people's mouth. If there are issues with the greater emphasis on tiebreakers for players, that can cause people with one loss to potentially miss out on the cut, as illustrated there in the Card Game DB article. But those tiebreakers also then, you know, if that encourages people to keep playing, I feel like they're kind of pushing at people from both sides there in ways that just, I don't know, creates annoyance, frustration.
It also
really interested in it.
It also requires that the system does tiebreakers properly, because I know a couple of people have been having some problems with the Tome software. It was used at a game night kit in Essex in the UK a couple of weekends back, and the person who definitely should have finished second was put fourth after the Swiss was completed, and as a result missed out on one of the prizes for top two in the Winter Game Night kit. And it's like, that's annoying enough when it's just a bit of swag from the Winter Game Night kit if you're missing out on a cut because of something that you suspect might be the software malfunctioning. That's going to hurt.
If you're missing out on the cut because you beat someone and then they drop, because once they've lost, they have no reason to continue.
Well, but they do, sort of. The system is trying to force them to play on out. That's the, I guess I didn't describe well the two sides they're pushing out there, where you're being encouraged to drop because you can't make it, but the system is also encouraging you to keep playing and, you know, feeling poorly the whole time, because if you drop, now that borks someone else so much harder.
It shouldn't. I just don't like the thought that, and Alex touched on travel, and I'm a very big traveler, and the thought of driving 7 hours to go 4-1 and miss out on a cut seems, I don't want to say it upsets me just thinking about it, but that's not okay. Like, it's not. You should be afforded one loss on a day and know with reasonable certainty that you can play your elimination rounds.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to go too much into it, partly because I already did and partly because the clarification article might explain some of it. But it does seem like the things they've done here have been designed to try to precisely to discourage people from traveling those long journeys. That's because they want store championships to sort of retain a local feel. I don't know, but I think isn't big enough for that to be a problem.
That's the only evidence I see when they claim, because I'm with Will, I think that the, oh, this is only meant for the store tournament level, was bull. And the only reason I would possibly, the only evidence I see for why it might actually be that is the strange number caps that it only the system only works to a certain player range, and then it just falls off a cliff. So if you're having a giant event, if you follow FFG rules, you have like a top 16 and only so many rounds of Swiss where only your undefeateds make it. I mean, that situation should never, ever happen. And you think for a game that you're trying to make your biggest and best, you would facilitate the sky being the limit, as opposed to having rules that very clearly break down when you get into 100-plus player tournaments.
There's just two main points, I guess, left on my mind that I want to hit on here without delving far down the specifics rabbit hole, as they've been documented very well on those articles on CardGameDB. And one is that it's boggling my mind here, in the paragraph talking about talking with competitive players, because I'm so curious about that. It also mentions consulting game developers running simulations and trial runs and such, but no one yet has admitted to being the consulted players, right?
You know, every competitive player in the game.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing I'm getting at. No one has been willing to admit that they were consulted. And the way this community is, like, even if it was someone new that was consulted on this, right? This new expanded growing player base that we're hoping for. Like, if they care enough about the game to be a competitive player and one that should be consulted on this, like, they would be out here in the forums, on the, you know, the website comments, talking with people, Skype group, whatever it might be. It, you know, it might not be all channels, but at least one, like, these would be people that are out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think if there was one person they'd talk to about it, it would be Alex Hines, because they, you know, they talked to him about the rules documents for the core set. They talked to him about everything, basically. And he not only wasn't talked about it, but found it so discouraging of resolution that he wrote an article about it.
Perhaps found it odious.
But when you think about the type of people, even when we don't know their names, so say the type of people you would want are passionate about the game, care about the game, and are comfortable with it on a competitive level. The people that go to Gen Con, go to Worlds, go to Stalic, and on top of that, do well. I mean, those are the names and people that you're going to trust with something like this. And I see none of those people going, yes, let's have a system that plays A, for shorter tournaments with less rounds, and B, that lends itself to more variance when you already have a young game that, where variance, I think, is everyone's biggest concern with it. Like, I just don't see people who understand the game and tournaments well enough to be consulted being okay with any of this on a fundamental level. Like, even if we don't know their names and go, oh, well, it's not a Bruno, it's not Alex, it's not Dark Naj, it's not Greg. Even if you just think about the kind of person they should be consulting, that kind of person would never want the direction that they went to happen.
Right. I think the people that probably would want it, potentially, would be owners of stores that don't want to have to run a tournament that starts at, you know, 9 a.m. and then finishes well after they normally shut up shop. I think for the really big potential championships, that's what they're trying to work towards. But I mean, ultimately, the hosts of those stores could easily just set their own rules about what Swiss rounds and what cut they wanted anyway. I don't see why they need a document to sort of back them up.
Yeah,
you know, I'm just curious. You're headed the direction I was kind of thinking there. I mean, how many shops is the average store championship or regional hitting those type of time constraints? I don't know of too many that do that. It's because I'm predominantly here in the Midwest of the U.S. I know, you know, tournaments do tend to be larger, for instance, across the pond there, but I have gathered that also those are more formally arranged than just a tournament in a shop. Am I right?
I mean, for the larger events, yes, like the Road to Starlight type events, but those would not come under this anyway, I don't think, because they're unofficial events and because they would probably count closer towards Premier than to competitive. Yeah, I think like Spain can get you know, consistently 20 plus players for their weekly tournaments. So for a store championship, you'd expect them to be able to get a very large amount. And I mean, like, I'm guessing New York can probably quite easily get sort of 40 or so for a store championship. Does that sound reasonable, Aaron?
I mean, it didn't for 1.0, but it does for 2.0.
But what store owner is like really bummed that he has people stuck in his store for 8 hours, like wandering it, buying snacks, maybe wandering through product aisles? Like, every tournament I've ever been to, store owners seem so pumped to have players in their store doing things in their store. I mean, they've all been, at least in my experience, have been welcoming and receptive. If not, just carte blanche, hey, however you guys want to run this, that's how I'll run it for you. I don't care. I've never come into an issue where they're like, oh, if only this tournament could be 3 rounds shorter.
I mean, you know, I can think offhand of two places where I have been the last few years where I know that is probably true, where the folks running and organizing and TOing top to bottom, you know, the event would very much like it to be a shorter event. You know where those two places are?
Worlds
and Gen Con, the ones run by FFG. It's not a stated goal here, but repeatedly I found it very interesting in yours and Alex's article there on Card Game DB and Drakey, I believe. Yeah. I don't want to leave him out. It's noted, oh, well, this wasn't a stated goal, but this does mean tournaments are shorter. Well, this wasn't a stated goal, but it does mean tournaments are shorter. And when you're at these large scale premier events like that, it is very common that these finals are midnight or later, and that the person running it, let's say Nate, who I see doing it most common, you know, is there from 8 a.m. to midnight or 2 and back in the shop the next morning to do it again. And on the one hand, yes, I feel for anyone subjected to that kind of work day. On the other hand, you know, I've got to be a little cynical about this and say the whole thing reads to me as, you know, we want shorter events at this scale. Yeah. That takes some workload off of people like that, but like, if you've got the demand, it's not that these work days are having to be put in because players are being over provided to. It's because there's that level of demand, and at that point, then don't you figure out a different schedule? You hire on a K-Tom or an Alex or somebody to help out for a day and split it up. I don't know. I feel like there are better solutions to ease that type of issue. And all of this type of change points to me as that being the actual underlying issue.
I mean, wait. Because they don't actually run the proper number of rounds at either Gen Con or Worlds ever. So they're still going to have this exact problem with these changes. Like, at both Gen Con and Worlds, like, I've missed the cut being 20th of, like, 140, 150 people. Because they're like, we're cutting to 16, fuck the right number of rounds. Like, they don't run enough rounds as is. So, like, maybe they're formalizing that they don't run enough rounds, but they never, at these major tournaments, run the right number of rounds. Ever.
Well, what other info do you glean from these? Let's look at the other things they say they did. So they run simulations and talk about it. What do those simulations show you? Oh, we have a million people with one loss, and we're going to lose half of them to a cut, or this cut in no way really. Like, the point of Swiss is to give you a spectrum to glean out the players, and those simulations say, okay, there's no way that we're doing that. You can't say with any kind of certainty that these truly are your top 4, your top 8, your top 2. Whatever that number is. So you don't, you just, all the simulations give you nothing but these bad, awful scenarios other than, like Will says, total number of rounds. These tournaments can be quote unquote concluded quicker than doing it the way the math says you should do the tournament. They're not concerned with getting, the emphasis goes from the players to the tournament runners. This benefits everyone organizing the event and does not help anyone participating. I mean, it just doesn't. Like, what name a benefit we get other than you can say with some certainty what time you need to set your dinner reservation.
Now, when I don't make the cut, I can blame the tournament rules rather than my own failings as a player. That's a benefit that I intend to use quite often.
I do like shifting the
blame. We already do that anyways. Talk about SOS and that SOB
yeah,
from
but now
round
we can do that every tournament, Kyle. Every tournament.
All right, guys, we've got another segment here. I think a little more positive, a little more interesting as far as it pertaining to the actual game rather than the tournament structure surrounding it. This one I'm kind of excited about because it's one James actually contacted us about and said, hey, I've got this idea. I want to come on and talk about it. So why don't you lay it on the listeners? What's the premise?
Okay, so basically when people build decks in second edition, they're mostly sort of looking at, okay, what's my main faction? Okay, I'll take, you know, say 40 or so cards from that faction. I'll top it off with my neutral cards. I'll figure out if I want this to be fealty or a banner. If it's a banner, I'll find the 12 best cards from the other banner, or, you know, from the other faction. And boom, that's my deck. And I think there's a lot of potential that's being left on the table, which is the idea of, ultimately, there's no reason why your main faction has to be the one that you take most of your cards from. It's the one that you can take your loyal cards from, but there's nothing saying, because this is a Baratheon deck, you have to run all of the Baratheon cards. You can run, you know, all of the non-loyal Lannister cards or the non-loyal Night's Watch cards or whatever else. And I'm not saying all these decks will be super competitive, but I certainly think some of them will be competitive enough that it's worth looking at. And it's also worth noting that if there is a deck where, say, you only want to take 6 cards from a faction and the banner is making you take 12, if you're not relying on any loyal cards from the other faction, you can just take the 6 cards from your main faction and then go with the majority from your banner. And then you're sort of getting around the downside of the agenda in a way. So there's a lot of just potential that I think people are ignoring that would be fun to look at.
I think there's 3 specific houses you want to do that in. I'm obviously not going to say them now, but I'll mention them as we touch upon them. Yeah.
Okay. And just one additional general thought is, I number one, kind of like the idea to begin with at the moment, but it's pretty much only bound to become a stronger option as the card pool deepens, right?
Definitely. I mean, Aaron can probably tell you a Martell card coming out in the next pack that is non-loyal and that is a centerpiece for a deck.
Yeah.
By Myria Clanned.
That might be the best character in the game the second it's printed.
It's a bold claim, but I'm not going to disagree. I think she's amazing.
Yeah.
And yeah, she's a great example. But if you're running a Martell deck, but you're not fussed about Doran and the Red Viper, and you can afford to give up Gaston Grey, then maybe you do want to take Nymeria into a different faction and see what you can do there. But we'll get to that when we get to Martell. One thing I want to say before we start also is I don't want to be the person who decides the name for this concept. My sort of, when I talk about it in my head, I call it a false banner, where your banner faction is sort of your main faction. I know Alex Hines, because I've spoken with him about it, he wants to call it a reverse banner, but I think that's kind of boring.
I like false banner quite a bit. Brings to mind the whole, well, because I love listening to conspiracy theories, the whole false flag attack sort of concept, which I think is perfectly fitting for Throne.
But yeah, I don't like being the person that names stuff. So maybe people can vote in the comments what they sort of want this concept to be known as. And then we can use the power of podcasts to force everyone to call it that, like with Aaron's mini curve.
Yeah, but I got Dave talked me out of that. It's not a mini curve. It's a
Oh, yes. It's the first edition curve. Yes.
That's such a great idea. Like, the second he said that, I was like, yeah, that is exactly what it is. I was wrong. He's drunker than I am, and I went. I'm all for not letting Alex Hines name anything, so I'm
cool. I mean, obviously, it doesn't have to just be between those two. If anyone has any cool suggestions, throw them at us.
Well, I'll just start calling it that, and then we'll catch up.
Cool. Okay, so should we start with Baratheon?
Yep.
Okay, so Baratheon's loyal cards. In the core set, there's Consolidation of Power, Lightbringer, Houses the Fury, Robert Baratheon, Stannis Baratheon, and the Red Keep. There aren't any in Taking the Black, but we've got spoiled in the upcoming chapter pack, Road to Winterfell, the event In the Name of Your King. So looking at those, obviously, their main power characters and their power grab are all loyal. Their draw is loyal, as is all draw, so that's probably not really worth pointing out. Houses the Fury is kind of a niche card. Consolidation of Power is a very strong card, but it's not sort of a vital card. In the Name of Your King is only probably for certain decks. So there is potential for Baratheon to be a stronger banner loyal. Obviously, Melisandre and the entire Neil module, other than Consolidation of Power, is non-loyal.
I'm tempted to include Robert as Neil.
Oh, yes, sorry, yeah. The Intimidate from Robert.
Lightbringer is also kind of Neil.
Yeah, the Relore trait.
Mm-hmm.
Lightbringer only go on Baratheon characters?
Yeah, Baratheon character only, and they have to be able to claim power for it to do anything other than just be a R'hllor trait.
Okay, so if it's breaking character only, that's obviously not going to really be effective in the false banner deck. What is
well, if you've got a bunch of Baratheon characters still, then it would be. Obviously, it won't in this case since it's low. But, so Baratheon. Sorry, you go.
Sorry, what's in the name of the king do?
In the name of your king is, during a military challenge, you may kneel your faction card to have the challenge end without a winner or loser.
I mean, that's a really powerful effect.
It is.
For me to think of another house that really wants it.
I mean, Night's Watch, potentially.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Night's Watch, the +2 for power challenges.
Yeah. This is one of the main things I want to talk about. I guess we can talk about it now. I was going to talk about it when we get to Night's Watch, but I'm of the opinion that in the majority of decks, people are running out of Night's Watch. They should be running them out of probably Baratheon.
Well, we tried it with Lannister on Beyond the White Book. Seems to be working reasonably well.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, as you say, the permanent +2 on the power challenges, the fact that Baratheon have got the Red Keep, which can sort of offset losing the Night's Watch draw, because as we'll see when we get to them, a lot of their loyal cards are to do with their draw. You're not losing that much from the defense by moving it out of Night's Watch. And Baratheon gains you Consolidation of Power, which is a fantastic card for stopping those little chump attacks that try and kneel at your board. After the next cycle, it will gain you in the name of your king.
Arrows of the Fury has got to be really good for that kind of deck, too, where you don't have to worry about what icons you have. If they're going to try and kneel out your major icon, do you let them do that, and then you just Arrows of the Fury to stand and defend it?
Yeah, I can agree with that.
I think... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, also, for other decks that are worth bannering to Baratheon for, even if you don't run many Baratheon cards, Consolidation of Power is not only great for stopping chump attackers, but also chump defenders, so it can be good if you're going sort of the unopposed route out of Greyjoy. But the problem there, as we'll see, is that Greyjoy have got a lot of good loyal cards.
Yeah, that is a problem.
Aside from just the loyal cards in the other faction, I'm curious, particularly the Night's Watch discussion just now kind of led my brain down this path, but I'm curious, if you're false bannering, what do you think is probably the max number of cards that you're running from your main faction?
I mean, it's tough to say. I mean, in that example with the Night's Watch with Baratheon, you're not going to want to run any of the big characters. You're probably going to want to run Melisandre. Even if it's just as a one-off for her kneel, you're probably going to want to run that Melisandre. You're probably going to want to run Shireen. Davos is going to be very good for the stealth on two icons.
So that leads me then, just wondering here, at what point are you including so many of these, you know, good cards or these modules or whatnot that you're pushing that count up to a point that, you know, maybe it should be swinging back to a more traditional deck construction sort of option.
A lot of that depends on how you want to win with the deck, I think, because if you're
right, which is why the Night's Watch led me down this path, because I feel like it wants a very specific set that I think could be a little smaller than some other stuff, where maybe you're leading down that kind of kneel slippery slope, so to speak, and suddenly you're looking at, well, I've got, you know, 22 Baratheon cards or whatever that number might finally be.
I think it depends a lot on how far down the Neil rabbit hole you go, as you say. Like, if you're just running a single Melisandre and then, you know, maybe one other R'hllor card that's good.
The Fiery Follower.
Yeah, like maybe the Fiery Followers to help with the dominance aspect. Then, sure, but then at that point, I think it still would be sort of more in false banner territory. If you decide, well, I want to be able to kneel out their board in order to be able to trigger the wall, and so I'm going to run 3 Melisandre, I'm going to run 3 Fiery Followers, I'll run 3 Seen in Flames, etc., etc. At that point, yeah, it becomes a bit more traditional.
So I think I have another good false banner for Baratheon.
Mm-hmm.
I think that a Baratheon to the Rose with a power grab focus should make a lot of sense.
There's even some really fun Nedley sense right there, isn't there?
Yeah.
Yeah. What were you thinking there, Aaron? Just sort of like using Lightbringer and Robert and...
And Randall, and then just saying, good luck stopping me from claiming a bunch of power really fast.
Yeah.
Red Keep to fuel your draw.
Mm-hmm. Chamber the Painted Table, potentially, to nab a little more power.
You could even pull the wrong draw trick and... consolidating your own character.
It's always a good feeling to win a game that way.
Yeah, it is.
We had a game where... the Barra player was on 12 power, to, I think it was Martell's 14 power. And he revealed heads on spikes to get up to 14 and then consolidated for the win. And there was a table flip.
It should have been.
It was beautiful. But yeah, I don't know what more there is to say about Baratheon. Should we move on to Greyjoy? Does anyone else have any parting thoughts on Baron?
No, I think I'm good to move.
Fair enough. Greyjoy, as I sort of alluded to earlier, has pretty much all of its core cards loyal. It's got, from the core set, Balon, Euron, Great Kraken, the Kraken's Grasp, and We Do Not Sow. Then from Taking the Black, both of its cards, Seastone Chair and Rise of the Kraken, are both loyal. And from the upcoming pack, the Reader is also loyal. Which, basically, other than the Kraken's Grasp, kind of is the spine of a Greyjoy deck right now.
Wait, you think
Other than the Kraken's Grasp, yeah.
I don't think the Kraken's Grasp is very good, and I keep being told I'm wrong. And I'm like, okay.
I mean, I think it's a solid event, but as James said, it's not really the backbone.
When I see Greyjoy lose, a lot of the reason I see them lose is because they go too high initiative, and functionally, if they don't, like, economy is still fairly fragile. If they don't see the right economy at the right time, things start to fall apart.
Yeah. Kraken's Grasp is, I'll say that again. Kraken's Grasp is what I'd call a nice event where you're never going to be thrilled, like, oh, yay, I got the Kraken's Grasp. That's going to bail me out of this situation. It's just, if you draw it, then sometimes it will do good work for you. And at that point, it's like, if I've got 59 cards and I'm looking for a 60th, I might throw one. Or, sorry, I have 60 cards and I'm looking for a 61st. I might throw one copy in, but I'm never going to put three in at the start and then build from there the way that I would with We Do Not Sow or with Balon Greyjoy or whoever.
Agree completely.
So Greyjoy, I don't think have much potential for being the banner, just like at least not in the false banner sense. Like you could use them as a normal banner, but I don't think you're going to go like 30 cards from Greyjoy as the banner faction just because all of their best stuff is loyal.
You could, but it's going to require a different set of cards. Like, you could build almost a Balon Voltron if there were enough strength pumps out of, say, Tyrell. Because, you know, I know how much you love Voltron.
Yeah, I was about to comment on you suggesting a Voltron deck there.
I prepared this in advance. I don't like Voltron decks very much. But there is potential for a Balon Greyjoy Voltron if another deck, and I'm assuming Tyrell because it's a stated theme of Marjorie goes solo with Balon, got enough strength pump stuff that you just build everything around Balon keeping them on the board.
Yeah, I think you could do Greyjoy as the main faction and have someone else as a false banner. Just like as you say, Balon is a good option to build around. That's really it, I guess, other than maybe like Euron, if you're going for some sort of location destruction deck, or like, you know, maybe if you're building Lannister and you want to intrigue all the locations out of their hand and then bring them in with Euron, but that still feels like you probably just want to be building Lannister at that point.
Yeah, it doesn't seem really worth it for that.
Yeah, Balon's the only sort of one of those that you can build around in that way that really would justify it, I think.
Right, and then you would get We Do Not Sow and the Reader.
Yeah, you get a few little bonuses from it.
You get all the other loyal cards as a bonus for Balon. Like, almost everything is built around Balon itself.
Okay, on to Lannister?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, so in the core set, they have Casterly Rock, Cersei Lannister, Grandmaester Pycelle, Hear Me Roar, Lannisport, the Queen's Assassin, and Tywin Lannister. Then from Taking the Black, they have Cersei's Wheelhouse, and from the upcoming pack, they have the Plot Warden of the West. So basically, the intrigue stuff.
I mean, if you really want gold, like, badly, you just want to run, like, Tywin and, I guess, the Wheelhouse, and just, like, try and pump up your gold, that's an option. And you can just run that and move on.
Yeah. You know, I think at least one of the intrigue cards does have some potential. Aaron may hate this, but Casterly Rock, I think there's some messes that may like the flexibility to have that extra challenge, particularly if you're going backwards to Greyjoy, you know?
You're thinking like a little bird on Asher and just hammering away with unopposed intrigues over and over.
Indeed.
I think so.
Yeah, I think that is one route. If there is enough in another house, or another faction rather, sorry, that you can go with the intrigue heavy stuff. Otherwise, it is basically Tywin would be the reason why you'd want Lannister as your main.
This does net you two different draw cards in Pycelle and Lannisport, for what that's worth.
So three different.
Mm-hmm. Oh, three, yeah. One of which is very easily searchable with Here to Serve.
Yeah, and the other two of which you can get with Support of the People as well.
So you could do something with, I mean, I don't think you should, but with my new favorite card coming out next set, it's possible you can do something with Martell as a false banner with this. Wheelhouse has some nice synergy with Sunspear as well.
Mm-hmm.
And since Martell's big cards, besides the obvious of Ghast and Grey, aren't that great, like, you're basically trading Ghast and Grey for Tywin and then running it just a really good Martell.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a viable route.
I don't know how good that would be. The more I think, like, I'm not entirely sure. It's just that would be a really good low curve deck. Like, an Arion would go really well with both Nymeria and Brainwork Tyrion.
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, it's hard to say for sure how well some of these would run, because it is actually a little bit of new territory, which is interesting and kind of nice to find, even this deep into the core set only. Okay, so we have one pack, but it feels like it's just been the core set for ages now.
Yeah. And other than you mentioned the Wheelhouse with the banners just then, other than that, the ones from the first pack aren't exactly reasons to false banner.
Right.
The Hound.
But he's loyal. So.
I just like thinking about the Hound.
When you have a spare moment in the day.
Yes. Well, then, Hound.
Fair enough. Shall we move on to Martell?
Yeah.
Okay, so their core loyal cards are Ario Hotar, Doran Martell, Doran's Game, Ghast and Grey, Greenblood Trader, and the Red Viper. Then from Taking the Black, they have the Long Plan. And from Road to Winterfell, they don't have any spoil.
This is the first of the three I was thinking of. Is like, yeah, obviously you could false banner here.
Yeah, I mean, you lose Ghast and Grey, you lose Ario Hotar, you lose the efficiency of the Greenblood Trader, and otherwise all the cards you lose are the somewhat janky win quickly with the Viper build, which I know you've been investigating, Aaron, but it's kind of built for fealty, that deck anyway, so.
I agree. No, I mean, I was thinking like them as the main house, but not running too many of their cards.
Oh, just sort of like pushing like the power grab or pushing the defense, or how would you?
It depends on the deck. Like with Lannister, you basically just run a good Lannister deck that has Ghast and Grey.
Yeah, I mean, and that's essentially the deck I'd done a while back. I feel like a lot of this revolves around Ghast and Grey as the choice loyal card to be picking up by building this way, right?
Yeah.
Could you make the argument that, sorry, the world's winning deck was a false banner to Tyrell?
Ooh.
Because it didn't, I mean, yeah, it used Ghast and Grey, Greenblood Trader, and Ario Hotar, but it didn't use Doran Martell or the Red Viper, did it?
No.
No. And that actually does remind me, though, of one thing that I feel like makes this a little rockier in Martell. As good as Ghast and Grey is, you are hampering yourself on the draw side because your option then really is the trader, because, come on, Doran?
And I like Doran, but even so, I think there's enough neutral draw that I'm not really worried about it, especially since Martell has the long plan, because you can long plan into Council Cavers.
Right.
Mm. I think the long plan, since we mentioned it, a great option for them, as numerous people have noted, is to go to Lannister, and then Tyrion with the long plan is just hilarious.
Yes. And then it's great to use that to, you know, fuel large enough things I do for love to bounce Tywin or what have you.
Yeah.
I mean, if you do it to Martell, if you do Martell to Lannister that way, you're running all the Lannister uniques and most of the Lords and Ladies, so you're getting Treachery and Things I Do for Love, and all sorts of really good stuff to go with your very, I guess, sort of few Martell cards, but they're still
going.
Yep. So, yeah. Other specific things it would be good to go to Martell with, I mean, Night's Watch again with the Wall. If you want to go defensive, then Ghast and Grey is a fantastic card for saying, well, you can attack, but your Jaime will bounce, your Tywin will bounce. You're going to lose all that power on him, and it's going to give me more time to set up my wall. And Ario Hotar, obviously, is also great for that.
Braithian should come in reasonably well as well.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff is around that Arion. Well, a lot of their bannerable stuff, like Davos and Melisandre, are right around that Arion point.
Yeah, although, obviously, if you Arion in Melisandre, you can't trigger her, which is a shame.
Right. They're always Arion and do things like that. But,
yeah. Also, going with Martell being the false banner, you have a few options. I mean, we mentioned Sunspear, which can be a very nice card for aggro decks. We've also got just stuff. They've got quite a lot of efficient cards at the lower end. Like, they've got the Bastard Daughter. They've got Edric, if you're running a faction that can spare the gold. They've got Maester Kaliot, or Kaliot, or however you pronounce that.
Mm-hmm.
No one knows.
Kaliot.
We just need to wait for him to appear in the TV show so that they can give a definitive answer that you guys will ignore.
Man, if he shows up and we don't get Ariane, I'm just going to be annoyed for it.
I'm still holding out hope for Asha's appearance, so, you know, it might be a while.
You could always false banner with them to Greyjoy. I mean, I don't know if it counts enough for false banner, but, like, if you stuck all of their cheap good stuff into Greyjoy and managed to go second, like, Balon with Sunsphere going second has got to be fairly terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say so. And obviously, confinement helps get the unopposed and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for that, you could always just Martell main house and just bring in Asha.
Yeah.
Although, I don't think that counts as a false banner, I guess. That's really just, like, Asha.
Yeah.
Asha's good.
She is. Okay, on to Nightwatch.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, the second that I think is a really good option for this.
Yeah, I agree. So their core cards are Amiga Contribution, Messenger Raven, Old Bear Mormont, Old Forest Hunter, Samwell Tarly, Take the Black, and Yoren. Then from Taking the Black, there's Will, and none spoiled so far from Road to Winterfell. So obviously the first thing you have to notice there is that the wall is not loyal. So you can basically run the entire defensive sub-theme that the faction's meant to be built around out of any faction.
I really figured you were going to point out that the first thing you should notice is Will.
Oh, is that you're loyal? Yes.
Yes.
He is, weirdly, he is possibly the like the strongest reason to stay in the Night's Watch if you're going defensive. Yeah. And it's not even for the inside, I don't think. I think it's just for having a stealthy bicon.
The stealthy bicon that you can stand with the Castle Black as well, isn't it?
Yeah. But yeah, otherwise, if you look at the Night's Watch stuff, all their loyal stuff, other than Old Bear and Will, it's like the stealing from your opponents, it's the draw that you can basically get from any faction other than Stark or Targaryen.
Hey, I'm sure that this is an accident, but thank God Old Bear is bad, because Night's Watch defense would be incredible if he was any good.
You think that was a masterstroke on the part of Nate when he was doing the corset? I'm going to make the defensive sub-theme a little too good, but then I'm going to make their 7 cost a week so that he can't actually push it over the top, just to sort of balance it.
And then their 6 cost is going to be, like, seemingly good, then actually kind of bad. Yeah, it's all about the plan.
Yeah. It's also worth noting that Jon Snow is also not loyal, so if you see an opportunity from another faction, oh, here's a few good attachments I can throw on him or whatever, then you can run...
They have to be weapons, so there can't be that many. There have to be weapons to stick on him. There can't be that many.
Yeah, they have to be weapons. Unlike stuff like Heartsbane or Ice, they have to be able to go on Night's Watch characters. There's a few issues. It might be something that, you know, 2 years from now takes someone completely off guard. And especially, I know, Sumi and Avanzar, but melee, that's definitely a potential route.
I don't understand what you're saying, but okay.
Not yet, but in the future, having a non-kneeling character that you can give renown could be very nice.
For the time being, I feel like Jon Snow's a false loyal card, because you need enough Night's Watch, and there's not enough non-loyal Night's Watch yet to reliably run him.
So he'd only work in a false banner at the moment, and there's not enough reason to false banner to him at the moment. So
I've got a bit of advice for people. If you're going to run a false banner to Night's Watch, I guess, is that how we're going to phrase that?
What, with like them as
being in and up?
Them as the main faction or them as the banner faction?
Them as the banner faction.
Okay.
Would that be a false banner to Night's Watch? Is that how we want to say
that? Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. So
would that be a false banner of Night's Watch?
False banner of the Watch.
Yes. There we go.
False banner of the Watch. False banner of the Watch. Make sure that you pick your house that has a lot of at least bicons that are relatively cheap. What is easy to miss is that most of Night's Watch cheap, or almost all of Night's Watch is really cheap stuff that you're going to need for setup and for defense and for board presence is loyal.
Yeah. Yeah, the Messenger Ravens, Old Forest Hunter, and Sam, and then Yoren at 3. Yeah, I think the main things you're missing if you don't keep Night's Watch are the stealth from Will, that cheap draw from the Messenger Ravens, so you have to be able to go to a faction that can accommodate you draw-wise, and, yeah, as you say, the consistency of the setups. The other stuff's kind of a bit fluff, really.
Most of their injury icons.
Sam and Yoren.
Sam and Yoren.
Yeah.
Like that. Oh, I mean, I guess they have the steward, but like that's all their intrigue, isn't it? I mean, Jon Snow, but that doesn't.
I mean, which is actually is a nice little point I'd kind of missed there, which makes them look pretty tasty for, I suppose, now the terminology would be a false banner of the lion.
Well, watch the video, guys.
Yeah. I mean, and they're the other house offering the most draw here, so I think maybe False Banner of the Sun possibly likes this to fill out just that draw. That's just what I keep coming back to with anything Martell main house. So
I can see that. Just building a Martell deck that runs 3 Messenger Ravens and Sam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty much.
I wish Jon Snow was 5. Why is Jon Snow not 5? One of the more underrated characters in the game, or I guess he's getting becoming properly rated now, is Benjen Stark, though. And Benjen Stark is Ariannable.
Yep.
Yep.
That would be fun if you're on, just to immediately go to the Shagger play rather than the actual useful yep. stuff. If you're on 13 power and they attack you military and you're like, okay, I'll trigger Ariane, put in Benjen, I win.
Then you, or if you're at like 10 power, you do that, then you heads on spike, then you cheat in consolidation of power yourself. It'll be great.
Nice.
You almost had me. I was so excited. So excited.
Well, clearly you win dominance in the middle of that. That's how you get the extra power.
Perfect.
But yeah. So other factions that it's worth maybe considering to go False Banner of the Watch with. I quite like Tyrell Banner of the Watch because Highgarden, it turns out, is very good in that defensive deck. And Tyrell is also possibly the faction that can best cope with losing the draw from Night's Watch.
Left and right.
And yeah, the wonderful cards that are left and right. They can help fill out the defensive theme. They've also got a Bicon at 2 cost, which is nice. There's a lot that you can do with Tyrell, I think, which I've not really seen anyone do, so I might have to build that.
It's worth a shot. I feel like, and maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like Tyrell is a little bit short on power icons. In the lower cost range. They'd have to be running, obviously, the Courtesan of the Rose type stuff.
Yeah, there's Courtesan of...
I mean, and their army has the power icon.
And like, that's 4. I'm talking, like, a lot of
okay.
what makes these decks go is they need actual, like, cheating.
The only non-unique below 4 cost is Kurtzan, and then you also have Left Sundhines and Marjorie.
And you could always just run 3...
Oh, and Garden Caretaker as well.
Yeah, you could run 3 of the 0-drop power icon attachment.
Yeah.
Because why not? It's really...
If you're going with Night's Watch, so many of them are no attachments except weapon that it's probably not worth it.
Yeah,
That's fair.
It's really good to make the, I don't remember the name of the knight that just came out. Oh, first back knight, Tyrell?
Arbor Knight?
The Arbor Knight, a Tricon.
Yeah, that is fun.
I like the sound of that.
Okay. Anything more for Night's Watch? Or?
Thinking, but I don't really think so.
I think just one of the things I'd say is I would urge people to look outside of Night's Watch faction as a whole and just see, think about your deck. Would it work better out of Baratheon, out of Martell, out of Lannister? Because I think... a disproportionately large amount of times compared to the other factions, the answer might actually be yes.
I mean, there is one more that's running. We just played it on Beyond the White Book. It's Kiddo Hart's deck. It was the like weirdly offensive first edition curve, Night's Watch, False Banner to Greyjoy. False Banner of Greyjoy.
Nice.
There was a lot of Greyjoy stuff in there. Like the majority of the characters were Greyjoy guys and then just loyal stuff, really. And the efficient Night's Watch, which is really just 2 cards. But it works really well.
Yeah.
So if you have the list up, if you want to check it out, but it's pretty good. I don't have it memorized enough to like list it off now. But it's built largely around Asha and Beyond being giant pains and some choke stuff. So you'd like it, James.
Nice. Oh, I'll have to have a look.
Okay.
Okay. On to Stark. Okay, so they have from the core set, Caitlin Stark, Grey Wind, Ice, Rob Stark, Summer, and Winter is Coming. And then no more loyal cards so far.
I think they're a terrible false banner.
Yeah, I agree. The the stuff that I want is here. And, you know, conversely, I'm not sure that I really want... I'm not sure what houses I want false bannering in to Stark.
I don't know. I think if you look at those Stark loyal cards, most of them... Not all of them, but most of them are about hard-hitting, high military claim.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not playing Stark for that reason, and there are reasons to play them other than that, you've got Bran, who is a fantastic card. You've got Sansa to power gain. You've got Arya, who's cheap stealth bicon. If you're playing it for those sorts of reasons, then you don't really need Stark as the main faction to make it work. They have terrible in-faction draw. Their in-faction draw location is one of the few that you can actually banner to. So you can run Gates of Winterfell out of any faction. And if you're running False Banner, then it might still actually be worth it if you've got, you know, 30 to 35 Stark cards in your deck. I think the problem that Stark got at the moment is that there aren't any other factions that complement their style of play enough. But I don't know how long that'll be the case for.
I like playing Stark. I think they go well with Tyrell and Lannister because those are the easiest houses, I think, to banner. They go okay with Greyjoy. I just feel like things like their main power cards, like Rob Stark really wants a bunch of Stark stuff.
Yeah, well, Rob Stark's loyal anyway, so you couldn't
That right. I meant like using Stark as a main house and then
bringing
a bunch of outside stuff is a little rough.
Yeah, I mean,
they're just a very insular house in their themes, in their card effects. You know, one of the main things that I kind of think of is just rounding out icons and income. And if that's what I'm looking at doing at that point, then it's probably a traditional banner that is probably the solution.
Yeah, I mean, I've been trying to make an aggro deck work between Stark and Targaryen. But the problem is, as we'll see when we get to Targaryen, all of the good aggro cards for both factions are loyal. So you can't really make it work. It's like, do I want Stark as the main faction and miss out on Dracarys, Khal Drogo, and the Plaza? Or do I want Targaryen as the main faction and miss out on Grey Wind, Ice, Winter is Coming? It's like, you lose either way.
Almost like they decided that stuff would be oppressive if you could play it all together?
Probably.
Hey, did I see your name in the playtesting book for the core? Well, never mind. Let's move on.
Who knows?
Okay. On to Targaryen then?
Sure.
Yeah, well, I just list off half of them, but I'll go through them again. So in the core set, they have loyal Daenerys Targaryen, Dracarys, Fire and Blood, Khal Drogo, Plaza of Punishment, and Viserys Targaryen. In Taking the Black, they've got Vyas Dothrak, and in Road to Winterfell, they're going to have Crown of Gold.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, basically, with a couple of exceptions, we're looking at Burn and Attachment Control as being the things that are loyal.
Yeah, but that's awesome, because you just take that stuff's all cheap, and you can bring in, like, Dave from New York did, basically a Lannister deck that just has some better setup cards and, like, super aggro. Because they can just kill stuff.
Yeah. Or even, you know, it hadn't really crossed my mind till now, I think a false Banner of the Kraken into this and going with the non-loyal unopposed stuff, at least out of Greyjoy, I think could go pretty far once you're able to supplement that with some of this burn.
Yeah, and I mean, Asher and Theon obviously go great with the Plaza. I will say the one problem with Targaryen as far as this goes is it's a little misleading with regards to the possibilities to banner in, because yes, Dracarys is loyal, but that basically isn't just taking up three spots, that's taking up like 10 to 12, depending on how many of the hatchlings you want to run.
That's fair. Back to the earlier thought with Baratheon, as far as if you're going that deep, maybe traditional is the way to go.
Possibly.
Okay. So on the non-loyal side, then, which are the things?
I mean, Jorah is a fantastic beat stick. I think the first sort of good stuff deck that we can build that's just pure efficiency is probably going to be Lannister and Targaryen one way round or the other. I don't know if that would necessarily work itself out as a false banner or not.
But I don't think you mean good stuff. I think you mean efficient stuff. Like bodies that have good cost to strength.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good stuff, but like efficient stuff.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of interesting mentioning the two of those, because I like three of the cards that I think of first in that type of pairing, Jorah, of course, like you said, but also Tyrion and Magister Illyrio, but conveniently or amusingly, none of those are loyal, so it really lets you play around with the pairing and construction of that in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and likewise, the Hound isn't loyal. But Braided Warrior isn't loyal, which obviously it's monocon, so it's not ultra amazing like the others, but it's still 2 cost for 3 strength, which can be very nice in these aggro decks.
A 3 for 4 dragon.
Yeah, 3 for 4 dragon in Drogo, or Drogon rather.
You've got 3 for 3 dragons, still fairly efficient.
Yeah, and the 2 for 2.
I mean, 2 icons, yeah.
All of the dragons are at least reasonable when it comes to that efficiency.
Right, I agree.
And at that point, maybe you go Targaryen for Dracarys.
I mean, if Night's Watch had a better icon spread, that would make a lot of sense to get all those nice, cheap, efficient Targ cards and some of that Night's Watch draw. You should be able to see a lot of them. And I think they need a slightly better icon spread before that gets too good.
Yeah, I think that's one of those things where, in a cycle or two, look back and it's definitely a possible deck. One other word of warning, I guess, if you're making Targaryen your main faction, is their only source of draw is Daenerys. And if you're not being able to run her because maybe you're predominantly running another faction and you don't want to clog it up with a 7-cost character at the top of your curve, you have no draw outside of the neutral stuff.
But you do have a lot of removal, which is still card advantage in general. Like Plaza, repeatable.
It's a bit more snowbally, though. Either you're getting the removal off early and then your few cards are beating the opponent's fewer cards, or you're not getting the removal off, the opponent's getting their draw going, and at that point it can be very tough to come back into the game, I think.
Agreed.
Okay, last faction?
I think so.
Okay, best of the lot, Tyrell. So their loyal cards from the core are Highgarden, Elena's Kine, Paxter Redwine, Amanda, and the Queen of Thorns. From Taking the Black, they've got Pleasure Barge, and then from the upcoming Road to Winterfell, they've got Lady in Waiting, which for anyone who hasn't seen it, I think it's she can be marshaled as a duplicate on a lady.
Yeah, Martell, please. Pretty please if you stick Martell with them, and then like all that, like all those little Martell control effects are amazing.
Yeah, can't disagree there. One thing that I think sticks out from Tyrell is that people play Tyrell, and rightly so a lot of the time, people play Tyrell as a rush faction. They see Randall Tarly, they see a character with renown that can participate in multiple challenges, and they think, well, yeah, obviously. And Knight of Flowers also as being one of the cheaper renowned characters in the game. You naturally want to build towards that. But if you're going Tyrell as your main faction, that's not really, or that's rather, if you want to run that, that's not really a reason to play Tyrell. Like, Pleasure Barge is a fantastic rush card. Otherwise, most of those cards are more about sort of either the big effects from like Queen of Thorns or the Manda, or they're about combo with Elena's Cunning, they're about control with Highgarden. There's nothing that really screams, I need to build my rush decks out of Tyrell.
Yeah.
Elena's. Oh, wait, no. The Informant isn't loyal. Yeah, no, agreed.
Right.
So I think that's one of the things I want to sort of encourage people to try, is if you're trying your Tyrell decks, try it as Banner of the Sun. I mean, to be fair, to be honest, I think more people need to play the main faction and not Banner of the Sun, so that might be poor advice. But I think a lot of people are building Tyrell, Banner of whatever, and thinking, well, why isn't my rush working quite right, isn't it? Maybe it's because you're not really taking advantage of the loyal cards.
Well, a lot of what Tyrell really is a main faction, is control. So what houses have best control that you can just stick with them?
As you say, Martell.
Yeah,
Being able to bring in Sunspear, being able to bring in Nymeria soon, being able to bring in Ariane, Confinement, the Bastard Daughters, just all of the usual good Martell stuff.
Is there any other non-loyal control that we can really think of? I think that might be it for now.
There's the Nihil and Baratheon.
Oh, true.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you get anything really out of that. Like, you're giving up basically, like, Robert for Highgarden, and that's, you know, not a very good trade. You're going to draw either way. Although the more draw is nice. Still, I think I might just have Robert.
Yeah, and regardless, you're still not pairing, you know, the Mander with that beefy stuff, i.e. Robert, so.
In that deck, with left and right being non-kneeling and with the Fiery Followers standing, I prefer Stannis, who's loyal to Baratheon.
Taking, I don't remember what it's called off the top of my head, so the card that steals a character from Night's Watch?
Take the Black.
Take the Black. I was going to call it Taking the Black again. I knew I was wrong. Is that loyal?
Yes.
That's a shame. That'd be good with packs.
Yes, yes, it would.
I guess there's not that many expensive non-loyal events.
Mm. Maybe once there are, that will be a reason to look at Tyrell more.
I like Paxter a lot, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, he's baby Tyler.
Yeah, basically. I mean, he made single-handedly makes Elena's Cunning really playable.
Yes, yeah. And Elena's Cunning is actually a great reason to actually be with Tyrell, I think, because you get the Paxter reduction, and you also get the combo with the Queen of Thorns. So that's three cards, all of which are loyal. Like, good luck playing that out of another faction.
It's a really good place to first edition curve, too. You have a lot of draw. You should have, since you'd be running the low curve, Highgarden is really good for that. And Olenna's Cunning lets you go get Varys when you're getting overrun.
Yeah.
All good stuff. I should build that. I'm going to build that.
Yeah, I think when we get some more non-loyal control, I think Tyrell as a main faction, for reasons other than fealty, will be more of a thing. Right now, I think, in most cases, they're best as a banner. Unless you are going for that Elena's Cunning style that you were just talking about. Yeah.
Okay. What was it?
Yeah.
Hey, what do we think of Lady in Waiting while we're here? Sorry.
The problem she's got at the moment is that, name the best lady characters in the game.
Margaery.
Mm-hmm.
Dany.
Yep.
Arya.
I would say Cersei's up there.
Mm-hmm.
Asha.
Mm-hmm.
Kat. That basically it?
I mean, there's Arianne, I'm not sure if anyone mentioned. There's, Caitlyn.
Yeah. I thought both of them if I didn't say them. Sorry.
Right. Sorry, maybe you said Ariane and I heard it. I don't know. But I think the problem is that half of those are loyal. Like, I'd love if I could play Lady in Waiting in a Targaryen deck and put her on Daenerys. I'd love if I could go intrigue heavy in Lannister and beef up Cersei with this free duplicate. But you can't.
Right, you're never going to have more than three ladies in a deck, no matter what house you banner to, I don't think.
I mean, at the moment, the maximum number, I think, is three, as you say. I guess four, because you can go Stark and have Arya and Sansa out.
That's not terrible. Sansa's really looking good.
Yeah. And to be fair, Lady in Waiting does have excellent synergy with Arya.
Sure.
So, yeah, that's a possibility. But Otherwise, it seems like Lady in Waiting is more of a card for a Tyrell mono deck that's just trying to beef up Queen of Thorns and Marjorie.
Yeah, and it's a later card.
Yeah, agreed.
They're still seeding the pool.
Seeding.
Yeah, you know, that actually sounded a lot worse than I meant it to.
This is another chapter of the book. If only that had come up in Props and Slops, it would have been the perfect close-off, right?
So good.
That should replace
so,
it.
So almost good.
We're done seeding them.
So, I guess that sends us to Props and Slops. How's that?
Good enough.
Does anybody have anything?
Yeah.
I mean, I do, but I didn't want to jump on anyone else's toes.
I had stuff, but can't remember it. So you guys go first, and I'll have a think.
I had a whole list that I ended up losing. I want a prop. Alex Stern, Patrick Haynes, John Andrews, and Lauren Finch. Those are four people that are writing and or contributing to the whitebookpodcast.com. They're all fantastic players and great people and friends. So props to all of them.
Yeah. So far, so good with the initiative to have more content on there. So I think it's going well.
Yeah, I agree. It's becoming a site I have to actually visit now. Before, it was just, oh, it's the place that you're hosting the podcast on, and it's got a forum that I haven't bothered to go on because I already have forums.
Exactly.
And now it's like, oh, you've got content on there. It's worth visiting. What's this?
And now the forums are somewhat worth visiting as well, now that I merged that into the comment system. So
come for the content, stay for the conversation.
We're getting there. We're getting there.
Discord's not half bad either.
Yeah, Discord is a nice little chat service, and the phone app works much better than the Skype phone app. So
that's not saying much, but nice.
Yeah, sadly it's not. If only I could record voice calls through Discord, I would swap over there for just about everything.
I like the main Skype chat still. Like, you don't get random Shearer being cranky appearances on them.
Yeah, that's fair. Get him to come join Discord.
Yeah, since he doesn't play Thrones, that seems unlikely.
Oh, well.
He played, like, two games.
He never opened Discord since he's got three that are sitting there sealed.
It, you know, it tells me that Discord is for people to play other games as well. Like, right now, I can see two people online, one playing RuneScape and one playing Elite Dangerous something.
I can always see
it cuts off.
RuneScape, but okay.
Yeah. So I'm going to go ahead and jump into prop here for a show that I've propped before. But it's a show that just started its second season. And that show is Gallivant. Now, wait, folks, before you comment, I've not actually watched the first two episodes of the new season yet. But I did just rewatch the first season in preparation, and it was just as funny as it was the first time around. So I'm very excited to get around to starting the new season, hopefully in time for next week's episode.
Cool.
Go watch it.
Okay. I have a prop. It's to the video game Crusader Kings 2, which at this point is quite an old game.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
But my fiance Becky recently restarted playing it again. And this time she's doing it with like all the console commands turned on. Which I didn't really know about. Obviously, being a PC game, you can mod the hell out of it. But the gist is that you can just sort of impregnate people whenever you want. It's called the pollinate command.
Oh my.
She's been, I want to say using it, but abusing it would be the correct term. She's been impregnating people on the day that they give birth. It's nothing better to bounce off the pregnancy with than another one. She's been using it to impregnate the queens of various foreign royals. She's also decided that it would be a hilarious idea to start an incest run, where she uses it repeatedly on members of her own family, including her own daughters, and then gets a family tree that's sort of more of a circular bush. Every time I get home from working weekends, she's been telling me, it's great. I impregnated all these people. Look at my family tree. It's a circle. It's amazing. So I don't know why I made that a prop and not a slop, thinking back about it. But yeah.
sometimes you don't realize till you've really worked your way through the implications.
Yeah.
I want to prop and swap, I guess. The Final Fantasy whatever thing for Android has a triple triad app.
Oh, does it?
A card game? Yeah.
Oh, uh-huh.
Except that it's five little diamond lives, and, like, they only replenish every 15 minutes, even in solo mode, which is a little silly. Like, I guess I could get it to play online, but, like, and they've made it really awkward to get really good cards, and I don't know. They kind of did it stupidly, but, like, still, it's triple triad, and I love that game, so I've been playing
Square going with the recent tradition of take something amazing from their history and then just sort of re-release it, but mess it up.
Yeah, that's what Square does.
Yeah. The one thing, good thing I will say about all the stuff with FF7 recently is it's made me start going back and playing the old game. And
I hate that game.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, it was so right. It's not my favorite, but I definitely don't hate it.
I like the story. It's an RPG, so story matters a lot to me.
I mean, it was very sort of formative for me because it was the first RPG, anything even remotely resembling it, that I played ever.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's every single time I play it, I get such amazing waves of nostalgia.
Shining Force 1 for me. So I.
Ooh, that's nice. You don't hear many folks talking about the Shining Force games. I am now suddenly propping Shining Force 2.
Yep, better game, but 1 is the one that I have all the nostalgia for.
Yeah, I always meant to try and track down a copy of Shining Force 3 to play on my Saturn, but turned out to be kind of expensive.
I did. I played it. I had a Saturn for a while. I played the crap out of it. Love Saturn. Fantastic system.
Yeah, but it is one of those things where all of the amazing games for it are so rare now.
Yeah.
My problem with Saturn is actually a little different. My problem with Saturn is that it's almost impossible to emulate, which drives me freaking crazy.
Right. I mean, it turns out it was also almost impossible to write software for directly. I don't know what Sega was thinking with the four processor thing. But
Dragon Force is such an amazing game. Props to Dragon Force, one of the best games I've ever played.
Let's just prop a lot of older RPG-style games. In fact, you know what? Let's just change the podcast over to talking about RPGs.
I remember I had a Sega Saturn and then sold it because I wanted to get a PlayStation because it actually had new games coming out for it. and then a few years later on, I got really nostalgic and bought a secondhand Saturn. And then one of my friends was like, oh, I have all these old demos that for some reason I was still holding on to. And he gave me one for Panzer Dragoon Saga. And the demo of that game is the entire disc one of that game.
Oh, wow.
And he got me insanely hooked on it. And then I reached the end of the disc and I'm like, okay, that's that. I have to go and get the game. And then I went online and it's like, okay, you can get this game. It'll cost you £140.
Jeez Louise.
I bought Panzer Dragoon Saga for like $120.
Is it good?
It's pretty wonderful, but it's not a game you want to play multiple times, so then I sold it for about the same amount. Like, it's very hard to play multiple times.
Man, I still got my Saturn. Now I'm going to have to look around and check out some prices on some games here.
Oh, I thought you were going to say look around and see if any of your TVs can like hold a SCART cable.
You know, that's actually a good question. I'm sure I'm going to have to buy some kind of adapter to actually use it.
This seems problematic.
I shouldn't be looking at eBay, looking at all these systems for sale. Man.
If the host is looking at eBay, does that mean that this pod has been cast now?
I think that closes another chapter of the White Book. Also, if you have any Sega Saturn games for sale, contact. I think that's an entirely different novel.
I don't know. Could be about your phone sex career.
Well, calling it a career is kind of a strong phrasing, I think.
Addiction?
Very strong.
Side gig?
Professional hobby?
There we go. I like the sound of that. Lends it a certain respectability, but not too serious.